Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy, beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, this is BJ.
Please record your message.
Oh, poo.
A couple days ago, we caught up with BJ Henry in a small campaign office in Burnet, Texas. Population, about 6,000 people.
Hello, is this Minnie? This is BJ with the Beto campaign. He's running for Senate against Ted Cruz.
In case you somehow haven't heard, there's this Senate race in Texas. A Democrat named Beto O'Rourke is credibly challenging Ted Cruz.
Is this, okay, she hung up. I mean, I got so many voters yesterday.
BJ is one of Beto's volunteers, working the phones to get out the votes. She takes note on a yellow pad of paper of every hang-up, every Cruz voter, and of course, every Beto supporter, as she makes call after call after call.
Are you a registered voter? Well, you know what, hon? I'm sorry to bother you, but you really ought to register to vote. It's very important. And sorry to bother you. Bye-bye.
Voter turnout is usually, historically, very low in Texas. Less than 35% of eligible Texans voted in the last midterm elections. And if Beto is even going to have a chance, he needs a huge Democratic turnout. And that means he needs people like BJ, who is doing the kinds of stuff she has never, ever done before.
Last Saturday, I had seven volunteers to block walk in the town of Bertram, which is a teeny, teeny, tiny place. And we split up, and we each had 25 names. So I go up to this house, and it was absolutely a shack. I was scared. It looked a little uncomfortable. So I get up on the porch. There's black screen netting over where the door is, so there's no door to knock on. And I have my Beto t-shirt on, and all of a sudden I hear this guy's voice come out, and he says, "Hey, you're either damn brave or damn stupid to be on a porch in this neighborhood." And I started to back off, and he goes, "But don't worry, honey, I'm going to vote for Beto."
I'm Kai Wright. This is the United States of Anxiety, Gender, Power, and the Midterm Elections. And in this episode, our reporter Amanda Aronchik brings us the story of a group of progressive women, many of whom have for a long, long time kept their politics to themselves because they are afraid of backlash from their families, their friends, and their communities. But now they are so horrified by Donald Trump, they've begun to organize in secret. We go to rural Texas to meet the underground resistance.
Emily?
Hello.
Hey. A few weeks ago, I called up Emily Van Doon. She's at the University of Texas at Austin doing research into politics and communication. After the election, an acquaintance told her about this group of women who meet in secret with the blinds drawn at an undisclosed location. At first, she wasn't welcome at their meetings. But eventually, once they had built trust, some of the women agreed to be interviewed for an academic paper. I asked her to read me what one of the women said.
So one woman mentioned she felt the need to do a secret handshake upon arriving at the first meeting by nightfall. She said just the day of driving in the middle of nowhere, in the country, and seeing taillights and taillights and taillights behind you. I think I was the first one to pull in, and then every car after that, people getting out. It was truly a feeling of like, we should do a secret handshake and look around us in the bushes. It was a very surreal kind of feeling. And then seeing who they were and not having had a clue before that those people felt the same way as I did, I don't know, it was a very unique experience.
Of course, I wanted to go to a meeting, but the women didn't want a journalist there. It took Emily months to be welcomed at the meetings, and so I sent her with a recorder instead.
Hi, Amanda. This is Emily. I am driving to the meeting, so I figured I'd give you a little background noise of the windy road on my way there.
They won't disclose what county they're in, but I know this. It's rural Texas. There are ranches and farms. And it's a place where, at night, you can see every light for miles and miles.
I am pulling into the place where they meet.
One more detail. In the last election, this community voted overwhelmingly for Donald Trump.
Hi, dog.
Emily arrives an hour before the meeting is scheduled to start. Only two of the women agreed to speak with me.
Okay, I think that we are recording. So what I'm going to do is hand off the phone to the first woman that you're going to interview.
Okay.
1 second.
The first woman didn't want us to use her real name, so we'll call her Eleanor.
When I first moved here, it's been some years, I was told personally when they found out who I was and where I had moved here from.
She's originally from the South, but she lived in a blue state for many years. So someone said to her, why don't you go back to where you came from?
You know, we don't want you here. Really. There were two occasions that happened to me, and we became withdrawn in terms of speaking out about how we felt for that very reason.
She realized back then that to be welcome in this community in Texas, she couldn't be politically active. She'd have to stop talking about politics.
I have a very large extended family in the area, and they are diehard Republicans and I guess you could call them evangelicals, and they are very, very much opposed to what I believe and what I think.
Are you able to still get together as a family?
No, but that happened long ago. I happen to be an atheist. I'm not a Christian, and they are very much upset by that. They have accused me of being the devil and various other things like that. So we have a delicate relationship, we'll put it. And my sister in particular, I still have a relationship with, but the day after the election, she came over gloating to my house about the fact that Trump had won, and that almost ended our relationship right there.
Trump's win was a shock for Eleanor, and on the day after the election, all she could do was call up her best friend.
We were crying over the telephone. We said, we have to get together. And so we met and literally just drove around in her car, just kind of crying and talking and saying, what could we do? And we kind of spontaneously said, well, we need to have some type of a therapy session. She said, we're grieving. And I said, yes.
So they send an email to women who they think might be like-minded. They get together for wine and cheese and crying. Then after that, they meet again and the group starts to grow. How do new people join if it's secret? Like, do you have to know somebody in the group?
Yes. Yeah, someone has to know them and invite them and bring them. Yes.
Okay.
Once you join this group and you sign an agreement agreeing to keep the rules of this group, then I send an invitation for them to join the secret Facebook group.
Everyone has agreed to follow the same rules. Rule number one, you have to be a woman. Rule number two, you have to be invited by someone who knows you well. And rule number three, outsiders shouldn't know who's in the group. And now that secret Facebook group has over 130 women in it. What do you worry about for them, or what do they worry about?
Well, they worry about being affected by the fact that they're Democratic. And I personally know one member of our group who was fired from her job because she voiced liberal Democratic ideas. I know two other women that think that they would lose business. So then I know several in the group that have spouses that do not agree with their point of view and are so adamant that they keep it hidden from their spouse what they're doing.
In some ways, Eleanor's story is a cautionary one. Some of the women in the group don't want to jeopardize their relationships like she did. They don't want to go home to their families or their husbands and have the same fight night after night. So they stay quiet. The other woman who agreed to speak with me, I'll call her Margaret, she's also in the group, and she keeps it a secret because she doesn't want to out any of the other women. But she has less at stake.
Like, I don't have young children depending on me. Mm. I'm not a single mother trying to run my own business with three little kids, trying to manage all alone in the world, and I'm dependent on all these people's business. I'm not. You know, I'm older, I'm retired, and I don't have to worry about that kind of stuff anymore. And so that allows me a certain amount of freedom that a lot of these other women don't have.
When the group started to be less of a therapy session and more of a political action group, they all mailed out postcards and made get-out-the-vote calls. But unlike the women who want to stay anonymous, Margaret's even gone to a few protests. It's there that she's seen the tensions in her community.
I've been at protests where there were counter-protesters, and it was unbelievably hostile.
She says there was this one time where she was part of a small protest outside a congressperson's office. But even though it was just a few dozen people with some handmade signs, counter-protesters showed up and set up across the street.
They all pulled in with their pickup trucks with guns on their gun racks. They get out of their pickup trucks and they're nasty and belligerent and shouting obscenities at us, and they're drinking beer. So here you have people who are publicly intoxicated, who are being aggressive and have guns on their gun racks. And the drunker they got, the more personal and obnoxious what they were yelling at us became, to the point where they were saying, well, yeah, y'all, you know we got guns here. All we got to do is cross this here street and come after you.
Emily Van Doon, the researcher who introduced me to these women, helped me understand why this secret group exists in rural Texas and not somewhere like New York City. If you wore a Make America Great hat and you walked down Broadway, you would probably get harassed. And so I would not at all be surprised to find out that there's a secret Trump group that meets, you know, and they don't tell their friends. And, you know, what is the difference between that and this group?
Yeah, I think the unique part about this group is that the small nature, the tight-knit nature, the dependence on their community as a rural area necessitates the secrecy some because they just do not have the choice in their community to just find other people.
If you put a Beto sign in your yard, everyone knows you live at that house and who you're voting for. There's no anonymity in rural Texas. But it's not like these women want to move somewhere else. They like it there. In some ways, they have a lot in common with their neighbors. It's a patriotic community.
They start every meeting with the Pledge of Allegiance. And they have a flag at the front of the room that they put into this easel. And they would just, like, tuck it in there so it's, like, elevated and everyone can see it so that when they're, you know, doing the Pledge of Allegiance, they're actually looking at a flag. And so in the middle of the meeting, the easel, which is just, like, old, buckles, and the flag comes, like, flying out of this easel. And I, like, just such a strong memory of them yelling from the back of the room, grab that flag, because it was going to hit the ground. At that moment, I was like, I'm in the middle of rural Texas. Everyone outside of this room essentially voted for Donald Trump. The people in this room did not, but they are so patriotic. They're willing to meet in this secret place and still pledge allegiance to the flag and still run to catch it before it hits the ground. And that's so powerful and so meaningful.
As a group, do you think there's anyone who suspects what you guys are up to?
Oh, there are people that suspect what we're up to, yes. But they haven't been able to figure it out exactly.
Really?
Yeah, well, we've heard that we had a spy in the Republican Party meeting and who came back and said, oh, they're worried. But they can't figure out what you're doing and where you're doing it.
So what did they say, though? Like, oh, we hear there's a group of women.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, there's this group. You know, they're on the rise. Better look out for them. You know, they're campaigning and they're making phone calls.
It seemed like they were starting to have an impact. There was even an article in the local paper noting that voter registrations were up.
And a part of it, we believe, is because of all the calling and campaigning and walking and whatnot that we've done. And at the very, very end of the article, there was just a little line that says, oh, yeah, those Democrats are out beating the bushes.
If you could predict, what do you think is going to happen?
I think that we'll have a new Democratic senator. And as far as down the ticket, I don't know. I think that that's less possible. But our candidate for senator, Beto, has done an excellent, excellent job of visiting every county in Texas. And he has a lot of enthusiasm. And he's winning over people that have maybe been borderline, because he's not running a nasty campaign. He's running a campaign that says, here is what we can do that's good and right and decent.
The women are really hopeful. But I think even if their candidate doesn't win, this has been pretty transformative for them. They're not necessarily all in the political closet anymore. What is it about the group that makes the difference?
Oh, gosh. You know, if you're alone somewhere and you feel like you're on an island, but yet you're surrounded by thousands of people, it's pretty lonely. And having this group of women has made an enormous difference to me. And knowing, just knowing that there are people out there that support me and what I believe and support our country and are working for the same goals, it just really, really makes a difference to me.
Living in Texas for all these years, Eleanor swallowed a part of herself. She'd convinced herself that voting privately, all alone in the voting booth, was enough. So every time there was an election, she would vote. And she's like, that's fine. I did my job. But since Trump won, she feels embarrassed that she thought that voting was enough. And now she's out of the political closet.
I don't care if my business suffers. I don't care if I suffer. I don't care if, you know, what they say to me or do to me. That's it. I'm done. And I'm not backing down anymore. I'm not keeping my mouth shut. I'm going out, no holds barred.
While some of the women in this group have become emboldened, others have not. They continue to hold meetings in secret. And there you have it. Emotion and anger are fueling this electorate. And coming up next, we talk to Rebecca Traister, who has been studying just this topic for her new book, Good and Mad: The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory, and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Rebecca Traister has been writing about women in politics, media, and entertainment from a feminist perspective for a long time, for places like New York Magazine, The Nation, and The New York Times. Her latest book, Good and Mad: The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger, has arrived just on time for this political moment. And when I sat down with her, I asked, did the women we met in Texas surprise her?
No, that totally resonates with me. In part, my family comes from an extremely conservative rural community in Maine where, you know, my mother grew up on a potato farm in very, very, very far northern Maine, very, very red Republican country, and I still spend a lot of time there. Mm-hmm. And I have spent some time in recent years talking to women and some men in that community whose politics are very different from the red politics that tend to prevail, and have also talked with them a little bit about exactly these dynamics, the fear and anxiety about being publicly known to differ politically.
Can you speak to how that sort of sense of isolation has, and maybe it hasn't been unique to women, but has it had a unique impact on the way women have been able to organize and come together to fight for power?
I think that sense of isolation and the discouragement of voicing of dissent amongst those who have been offered less power is tactical, is structural. I mean, that's part of how you prevent them from organizing, is you keep them away from each other. That's one of the reasons, one of the arguments that I make in my book about women's anger is politically consequential, is that among the many reasons that it is discouraged or treated as marginal or unattractive or dangerous is because a lot of the history of progressive organizing amongst those women, people of color, working people, a lot of organizing comes when people who are angry at inequality or angry at injustice start speaking to each other about their shared frustrations and then start organizing and trying to imagine ways of challenging the power system that's leaving them with less power. But if you discourage them from voicing their dissent, from voicing their anger, they're inaudible to each other, unknown to each other.
So when I'm thinking about these women in Texas that we've been talking to, and there's sort of some of them are ready. Some of them are like, yeah, I'm coming out. I'm going to be open about this. And others are still sort of, you know, I'm angry, but I'm not ready to be in public about that. What do you say to them? What's the step out of it?
Well, I think the most crucial step that I recommend is connecting to other people who share your frustration. More than it's about public expression, I think that the tolls on women who do express that anger, especially if it's in a way that's disruptive to the communities or sometimes the families within which they live, those tolls are real, and I don't want to minimize them. I've heard so many women, and this has been true as I've been on a book tour and talking to hundreds of women around the country about their experiences of recent sort of political activation and engagement. Many of them talk about feeling more in touch with themselves than they ever have before. It's gratifying for some women, but there's no way that I wouldn't concede that it also takes tolls on people's personal lives and their personal relationships. And so I would be very hesitant about sort of advising anybody to behave publicly in certain ways. I am much more apt to urge people to find, in whatever ways are comfortable, connections and ways of doing something that work for them so that they're not just sitting isolated alone in their homes anymore. But if they're working with other women, then I think that that's a good thing.
That was Rebecca Traister, author of Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. Next time, we go to Georgia, where Stacey Abrams is leading a movement that she hopes will make history by turning her into the first Black woman ever to serve as governor in the United States of America. And hey, if you've been enjoying this podcast, we hope that you will subscribe, and we hope that you'll leave a review. It really helps people find us and join our community. So tell your friends about us. But more than that, Election Day is coming. So hey, go vote. United States of Anxiety is a production of WNYC Studios in the newsroom of WNYC. This episode was reported by Amanda Aronchik. It was edited by Christopher Wirth. Casey Means is our technical director. Our theme music was written by Hannes Brown and performed by the Outer Borough Brass Band. Our intern is Allison Light, and special thanks to Caroline Covington. She was the one who went out to the Beto campaign office for us in Texas. Our team also includes Christopher Johnson, Jessica Miller, Kari Pitkin, Melinda Siriwardana, Courtney Stein, and Vera Lynn Williams. Karen Frillman is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is vice president of news for WNYC, and I'm Kai Ray. Thanks for listening. The United States of Anxiety is supported in part by the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Additional support for WNYC's election coverage is provided by Emerson Collective, the New York Community Trust, and New York Public Radio trustee, Dr. Mary White.
Notes from America is supported by Future Hindsight, an award-winning podcast that shares big ideas about participating in American democracy beyond voting, but short of running for office. Join host Mila Atmos for stimulating and incisive conversations with citizen changemakers on topics ranging from gerrymandering, policing equity, and voting rights. In this election year, Future Hindsight offers an unaffiliated perspective into what's at stake and how citizens can make an impact at the local, state, and national level. You'll always come away with something hopeful. Tune in every Thursday to get engaged and stay engaged.